My tactics were to adopt a certain kind of world-weary, jaded, anxious neuroticism.
Which David Rakoff has done brilliantly in his frequent appearances with Ira Glass on This American Life.
Because, let's face it, in New York City, I'm a Jewish guy with dark hair who works in publishing with a gift for the gab. You know, I meet myself coming and going 12 to 14 times an hour. So, you know, occasionally I'll need that little bit of spice. And what's more spicy than being Canadian, I ask you?
Well, the spicy Canadian humorist and writer has come to New England. Rakoff is visiting writer at Lesley University, and he's getting ready for a free public reading in Cambridge tonight. But you don't have to wait until then to speak with him. Do you have a favorite David Rakoff story? And what's your question for the writer who's brought you stories of frenemies, or sad sack office birthday parties, or climbing Mount Monadnock on Christmas Day? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And it is my extreme pleasure now to welcome into our studio David Rakoff. He's author of a number of books, but the forthcoming one is titled Half Empty. David Rakoff, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let me first of all ask you about this new book, Half Empty. You've said that it's essentially about pessimism and melancholy, which are very rich wells to draw from when it comes to writing inspiration. But I wonder, how did those themes differ from what you've tackled before?
Well, they don't really differ. You're absolutely right. It is sort of more of a ratcheting up of elements that are certainly ever present in everything that I've ever written, because no matter how funny or rollicking anything I write about starts out as, invariably the despair and the melancholy sort of come through. And that's unfortunate, both stylistically and as a way of living one's life. But the reason the book came into being was we seemed to be at a stage just culturally when I started writing the book, and then, of course, it took me so many more years than I thought it would, where optimism was not just carrying the day, but there was only room for that mm-hmm. in the national discourse, and that a kind of baseless, groundless optimism and willful ignoring of any kind of contingency or anything was really leading us to the brink of geopolitical global disaster. And it seemed to me that an emotion and a stance worth defending. And so the book is a collection of essays, and the hope is that the disparate elements, you know, assemble themselves into some sort of defensive emotion that is perceived to be negative, but has its uses, has its beauties, has its, you know, its place.
Mm-hmm. So you are planting your flag in defense here of melancholy.
Yes.
And that they're beautiful and necessary. So it almost makes me wonder if it's, you're saying that optimism has brought us to the brink of destruction.
Yes.
So how is it, give us an example of how you, or maybe a little bit of how you think melancholy can counter that.
Well, I think that melancholy comes with, melancholy and pessimism actually psychologically state, and actually this is actual science that I'm getting into now, they do narrow thinking. They make you think about contingencies and details. Optimism tends to broaden thinking, broad strokes, and it's you need both working in concert. So if, for example, there had been some narrowing thinking that said, hey, I've got an idea. How about some extra soldiers just to protect those vases? You know, just for the vases in that Iraqi museum. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean that one is unpatriotic, correct? So that's what I'm talking about, a kind of tempering of the national exuberance with some contingency thinking.
It's maybe a global view, a global take on what we all feel when we, you know, we see that incessantly happy person that after a while you just can't stand anymore. But
precisely.
But let me ask you, David Rakoff, so you are here in up in Cambridge in the greater Boston area, and we are delighted that you've been here at Lesley University. But it's not your first time in New England. You were actually back here in 1998, and you told a story on This American Life about climbing Mount Monadnock up in New Hampshire On Christmas Day, which for anyone who's been up in the White Mountains, the very thought that you'd be hiking on Christmas Day
is exactly.
quite a story just in and of itself. But you were writing a story for Outdoors Magazine about Larry Davis, a man who's climbed Mount Monadnock every day for 8 years. You climbed with him. And so I want to play a little bit of tape from that This American Life episode where you describe how much of the story kind of is about how defensive you feel about being this Canadian / New Yorker / gay / Jewish writer finding himself in a small New Hampshire town. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
Okay. I realize I've done almost no research for this trip, so I walk into downtown Jaffrey to check things out. The car passes and immediately circles back. The driver rolls down his window and asks me if I want a lift. I do not, but how nice, I think. He drives on. I'm charmed by the congeniality of this interchange. How friendly, how uncreepy. I speak too soon. He circles back. He hands me a rectangular package in tartan wrapping paper. Take this. It's the most watched video in the world, he says. This man is giving me a copy of Forrest Gump. It's the life of Jesus. I beg off politely, claiming Judaic immunity. He drives on. I return to the inn, now wreathed in the kind of Christmas in New England warm-hearted, cheery verisimilitude that Ralph Lauren would burn down a synagogue to achieve.
But so, you end up saying...
There goes my endorsement.
Well, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But you also end up saying that by the end of the climb, when you're near the top of the mountain, that you find you're the only one who's casting strange glances of disapproval, essentially, at yourself. So you kind of had a change of heart in terms of those Ralph Lauren-type perfect New England winter Christmas holidays. But I just have to ask you, so 12 years later... being back in New England, is your take on New England and New Englanders any different than it was that Christmas day on top of Mount Monadnock?
Well, here's the thing. I actually think it was longer than 12 years ago. I think it was like 14 years ago.
Oh, okay.
I think it was 96 or 95. It was always only ever a scrutinizing of myself. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It was always only, the disapproval was only ever of myself. The thing is that I was so... convinced that all my signifiers, such as they were, would be blaring sirens of otherness and persecute me. And of course, all anybody ever sees is dark hair.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, that is the taxonomy. Dark hair. That's all anyone cares about. Is it different? Yes, it's very different. And the reason it's different is because climbing the mountain in the middle of an ice storm was very scary for me. And I had to go in a little plane. That was very scary. It was the first time... Also, I was starting out my writing career. It was the first time that I'd been sent anywhere on someone's dime. So that felt like an audition. Everything was freighted with a kind of make-or-break terror for me. So now I'm much older than that. I'm a middle-aged man now, and then I was just a young cub reporter. So, yeah, things are somewhat different. Do I still feel that intense self-consciousness? It's a little less extreme mm-hmm. than it used to be. But coming up here on the train, you know, in the quiet car, there is no greater invention than the Amtrak quiet car. It's just sublime. I wish I were there, you know, right after this. But it is astonishingly pretty here in New England. Anyway, you know, we sped through all these towns on the water with beautiful gray shingled houses on stilts and boats on shining water. It was very, very beautiful. And from the window of a moving train in a temperature controlled environment with a library like silence, it was deeply lovely, I must say.
It is as if you were witnessing a postcard come to life.
Precisely. It was very, very nice.
Well, David Rakoff, it's not that often that we get the pleasure of having a This American Life regular here in our studio. So let me just ask you, I mean, I've read that you say you credit both Ira Glass and David Sedaris as changing your life or really making your career for you. Why do you say that?
Well, I say it because it's absolutely true. I was, pardon me, I'm going through puberty here on the air. We should do that for your fundraiser.
The ever youthful David Rakoff.
That's right. So dewy, so fresh. So, I really do credit both of them with giving me my writing career. David, because David and I were friends and we were doing theater together, and it was my fondest dream at that point in my life to have a creative life. But I was working in book publishing as a in various capacities, in either editorial or as an in-house speechwriter, but I had not yet managed to make the leap to allow myself to think of myself as a creative person, even though it was my fondest dream. Perhaps because it was my fondest dream, I cauterized that and never thought of it. And it was David who sort of saw something in me, and he said, well, why not? You know, and that was very, to use a kind of an icky word, it was very empowering in that way. Ira simply mechanically, I mean physically, gave me my break. I knew Ira before he had started the show. He was just a reporter, and he was friends with David. And then he began this show, and it provided me with a forum that was kind of extraordinary. The piece that you played the clip of was the piece behind the piece that was assigned to me by Outside Magazine. Mm-hmm. At that point, I was still just a reporter. And so my particular take on things, the way I was feeling about things, was really of no importance or interest to the various magazines I was writing for. I was not hired as a personage or a personality or even as much of a stylist. I was hired as a reporter, so I was meant to be absent. So Ira and the show really gave me, and many other writers, I think a lot of writers would credit them with this, gave me a forum in which to appear as an individual and my voice. And that was an incredible gift.
And it's a gift that keeps on giving for we, listeners, who get to hear you. So on that note, actually, I mean, I have the habit of always asking the very big question in the last 40 seconds of the program, and I will refrain from doing that.
No, ask it.
Well, I mean, the big question was, in that case, is there anything that This American Life, being on the radio, that you can't write for that versus what you could write in print? I mean, because we love hearing your voice, but it's a different kind of experience than reading what you've done in your essays.
Well, on the radio, I'm a little less boring than I am in print. But it's the same sort of thing because luckily enough I turn out to read and speak very similarly, which is in a kind of a schoolmarmish, highly adjectival, for want of a better term, you know, kind of gay sort of way.
Well, you can actually experience both the writing and the voice tonight at 7 o'clock, because David Rakoff is kicking off a week of readings. Leslie, he's the writer in visiting writer, I should say, at Lesley University in Cambridge. And that series begins tonight, once again, at 7 o'clock. David Rakoff, frequent contributor to This American Life from PRI. You can hear it here on WBUR. And your new book as well. Looking forward to that when it comes out in September.
Yes.
Half Empty. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, when we come back, Massachusetts Speaker of the House Robert DeLeo joins us. It's your opportunity to speak with one of the most powerful politicians in the state on just about anything. I hear there's this issue that's raised a lot of people's passions, something about casinos? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to connect with Robert DeLeo. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.